Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and soon you'll be listening to that elusive character from Twitter that everybody's so curious about. You'll be listening to an interview we had with Ruth Bourdin. So anyhow, anybody get any drift of who this might be? Be sure to take notes and then email us.
Yeah, we want in on the secret, but we promised we wouldn't try to find out who it was. But I guess if somebody tells us, that's all right. Huh?
I guess.
I think Ruth is going to appear on Sirius Radio sometime soon. He's also going to be on the Martha Stewart Show. I'm not quite sure how he's going to do that, but perhaps he's going to muffle his voice in the same way as he did when he talked to us. I think he borrowed a machine from either the CIA or the FBI or the Mossad or somebody like that.
Ruth here is talking about his or her book.
And the voice quality doesn't have anything to do with me. Okay, so
granted.
Anyway, listen up. I'm sure you'll find it fascinating.
Well, we have the great honor today of interviewing Ruth Bourdin, the James Beard Foundation Award winner for Best Humorous Writing. Was that, Ruth, the very first award for humor and food writing?
Yes, it was the first year that the award was presented, and I was honored to receive it, and it caused a little bit of controversy, because even though I think hopefully some people could recognize this as humor, it was given out in the context of the Foundation's Journalism Awards, and some journalists were upset that this would be considered under the rubric of journalism.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm for you, because, and I'm a journalist, I think you were exceptionally hysterical and hilarious, I guess. We're going to be talking to you about your new book, Comfort Me with Awful, Ruth Bourdin's Guide to Gastronomy. But before we do that, I think we ought to explain to people who've been living under a rock for the last 2 years, what is Ruth Bourdin?
So Ruth Bourdin is what you might call a Twitter mashup. It takes two major food world personalities, and that would be Ruth Reichel and Anthony Bourdain, and combines them into a culinary monstrosity. So it started really with Ruth Reichel on Twitter has a very unique voice, and she tweets in a very poetic way, almost haikus about her food experiences. And what I have done with this character is to take it and take those tweets and mash them up with Anthony Bourdain's persona, which is logical, obscene, rude, great. I love it, but a polar opposite of Ruth Reichel.
I mean, I don't know what gave you the idea, but it was a stroke of genius.
Well, I have to give some credit to Anthony Bourdain, who was doing his own radio show on the Sirius Network and decided to start reading Ruth Reichel's tweets aloud on his show. What I did here was take it to the next level and spoof the tweets themselves by inserting his persona.
It's true. I forgot about that. Now, your title, this is a book we're talking about, not a modest book. This is a huge guide to gastronomy, which is a massive subject. How did you get interested in writing such a book?
Well, the original satire was just of Ruth Reichel tweets, but over time, the Twitter character has grown to spoof everything in the food world. So it made sense to me that this character, you know, if he or she was to write a book, it would have to be about the entire food world. And there's a little bit of a Colbert aspect to it, of taking on this role of being this omnipotent super authority of the food world. And that, I think, also provides an opportunity to
title of the book is a takeoff on one of Ruth's books called Comfort Me with Apples.
Yes.
And who dreamed up the wonderful, what do you call it, an avatar?
So we actually hired, working with my agent and the publisher, we hired a young woman from Barcelona. We found her online, and she drew that for us.
How have you managed to have so many people keep your identity a secret for this long?
That's a good question. I have been extremely discreet. This interview is an example of it. I have modulated my voice, obviously. I hope your listeners understand that this is not how I sound in real life. But I've been discreet. My family knows who I am. There's a couple of food world people out there who know my secrets. But otherwise, I've just worked very hard to avoid going public.
Well, yes, everyone was waiting for you to stand up and receive your beard medal at the event last spring. And I truly thought you might do that.
I thought of it, but my feeling was if this character was going to continue on, do a book, I really had to stay confidential. I think this is great for people to come up with their own vision of an imagination of who this person is if they can't assign an identity to an author.
Well, now, part of your purpose of this book is to, in a humorous way, really give people an idea of what's going on in the food world, what has gone on, and what is currently going on. I love your definitions of the different kinds of foodies and the cartoons you have, the drawings of all the things like curd nerds, which is a great idea.
Yeah, you know what? I tried to do it in a funny way. I made up some funny names. But the reality is, that's what the food world is these days. It's extremely diverse. It's filled with so many obsessives, whether it's about coffee, cheese, foie gras. And the fun was to not only put it on paper, but to play around with and tease about these food tribes.
Now, there are some people that you clearly do not like. Now, I'm starting by what I'm sure you would admit. You do admire Ruth Reichel and Tony Bourdain. And you've also mentioned people you like, such as Eric Repair. I'm trying to think of who else you admire. There are people that you definitely do not admire. This isn't made. Is this assumed just because of Tony Bourdain's thing? Your Guy Fieri comments are outrageous.
Yes, this is the Bourdain influence on the character. Food network personalities, particularly Guy Fieri, are top enemy of Ruth Bourdain. And there's very deep-seated animosity. And what it's really doing is it's poking fun at Bourdain himself, who is constantly attacking this character. And I'm not really getting into whether Guy Fieri deserves this level of hatred, but playing around with poking fun at the haters.
I see. And the same's true with Alice Waters?
Yes. So, again, with Ruth Bourdain, there's not a lot of gray areas or gradation. You piss off Ruth Bourdain, and that character will come down hard. So, Alice Waters is, I would say, after Guy Fieri, enemy number two. Now, I should say that the real Alice Waters was very kind and last year tweeted on April Fool's Day that she was, in fact, the secret person behind Ruth Bourdain. So, stepping out of character for a minute, I appreciate her a lot.
But I bet you like Paula Deen a whole lot, huh?
Oh, Paula Deen is definitely on the hit list of Ruth Bourdain.
It's almost like the Paula Deen character was created so that you could be successful.
Exactly. It's almost like Ruth Bourdain is like the polar opposite of these food world characters. I don't know if Ruth Bourdain could even exist without our celebrity chef culture.
What about Martha Stewart?
Martha Stewart. One thing I think that Ruth Bader would share with Martha Stewart is she likes to party. I mean, she drinks a lot of alcohol and and I think that they could be friends.
Oh, no kidding. But you haven't made a proposal yet, huh?
No proposal yet. Although I will be on the Martha Stewart Radio Network on Sirius doing an interview soon.
Now, how are you going to handle that? You're going to use the same modification that you're using now?
Probably, as long as this works today.
Yeah, we'll see how it works. There's some absolutely hysterical chapters that I'd like to go over with you. One of them is this choosing a chicken. Could you explain about all the questions that come up when you're trying to decide whether or not to buy a chicken? I loved it.
Flowchart of how to choose a chicken. And it's a parody of the kind of thing you might see in a magazine of trying to dissect and explain different kinds of labeling, whether it's organic or air-chilled or, who knows, free-range. So what this does is takes it to an extreme and plays around with it and pokes fun by asking, okay, well, if the chicken was free-range, that's one criteria, but how free-range? Did it have little visits? Were they with celebrity chef Todd English?
Yeah, tell me about that. That's another one that you really make fun of. What does Todd English have to do with this chicken process?
He doesn't. He's just the poor guy who's been roped in to unfortunate and disturbing interactions with a chicken.
I want to have you change direction just with me, Ruth, if you would be so kind. I don't think I'm springing this on you unnecessarily, but several years ago, when the Dilbert cartoon was particularly popular, and everyone knew who wrote it, in fact, he was still at the time employed by the telephone company in California, gave a presentation at a conference I was at, and the subject was all the Dilberts that the lawyers said couldn't be run in the comic strip. I'm wondering, from the point of view of Ruth Bourdin, is there anything that's sort of off limits? Is there something that you sort of wanted to tweet or you wanted to post and you just said, no, that's over the top?
Well, you know, the great thing about Twitter is you get this immediate feedback. So the best thing is just you have an idea, go out there, write it, and get the reaction. The worst thing that happens is it falls flat and nobody cares. On the other hand, the best thing is you can get a great reaction, see if people liked it. So that's an interesting thing about writing on Twitter. The other thing is, they probably, despite how grotesque this creature is, there is a level of self-censorship. I'm not interested in hurting people's feelings. You know, I'm assuming, hopefully, that somebody like a Guy Fieri or a Paul Dean can see this for what it is. It is taking the attacks on them and twisting them to make them so extreme they're a joke. So, I don't know if it's self-censorship or what, but my goal is not to be mean-spirited as the character can be.
You have a wonderful, you must have spent a lot of time thinking up terminology, because this whole section called A Field Guide to the Modern Foodie includes carnivores, gastrosexuals, and curd nerds, among others. How long does it take you to come up with these ideas?
The disturbing thing is some of those words, like gastrosexuals, are actually in the food lexicon. I didn't make that up. On the other hand, something like floppers, which would be devotees of foie gras, or, can I say this on the radio, fockers, which I'm using a very precise pronunciation, would be lovers of Vietnamese noodle soup. Playing around with language and really fun to make out of.
Now, you have a section on celebrity chef's hair.
Yes.
And it's so vivid. I mean, you just look at the pictures and you know who they are if you know anything about the food world. But I noticed, it, as we spoke before, you didn't do tattoos. I think this is something that a celebrity chef has got to do now.
Yes, I think that should be my next book, a coffee table book.
On textures. That's good.
Yeah, goal for chef's pieces. You have to have a number of tattoos, preferably covering your arm, or a tramp stamp of Julia Child on your lower back. You really can't be successful these days without imprinting your body with the history of gastronomy.
Hold on a second. I think that I would take issue with that, because I'm not sure that I can imagine Alain Ducasse and Thomas Keller with tats.
You know, I use the word tramp stamp specifically. That's a tattoo on your lower back. You probably have not seen Alain Ducasse or Thomas Keller, but they both feature them on their lower back, and if you've ever seen them on vacation someday, then you would know.
Okay, so you have, huh?
Well, Ruth.
Ruth has.
Ruth, you're hedging. How about your guide to food acronyms? I mean, they were new to me, to tell you the truth. Like FMLP is what?
Oh, my God, you're throwing me for a loop. I can't even remember what I wrote.
It's
I have
called
to...
Fuck My Liver Pate. I mean, these are really... I love AP.
Yeah, these are acronyms. People need to know if they're communicating on Twitter or texting their friends while they're making dinner. These are shortcuts that you can use. So, yes, FMLP, Fuck My Liver Pate, is a good shorthand to use.
And I must say that anybody getting this book should also sign up for some of these quizzes to determine your status as a foodie. You have all these different quizzes to take.
Yes, throughout the book there are quizzes to figure out if you could be a hipster butcher or a sommelier, or if you have what it takes to be a restaurant critic. And then the end of the book, there's what I call the GQ, the gastronomical quotient, which is a 50-question test of your gastronomical knowledge, with everything from true and false questions to reading comprehension. So, and depending on your level of knowledge, you can rate your GQ, your gastronomical quotient.
Now, there was I thinking you were parodying either John Mariani or Alan Richman.
And that's also a little bit of a parody of there are books out there like the Hipster Handbook. They have quizzes like that. And this is playing fun with people's knowledge of the food world.
It does get wild, does it not? You indicated a sequel already. You indicated a sequel to this book. I mean, I'm interested in knowing, like, you obviously have a day job. I mean, how much time do you spend on Twitter, and how much time did you spend on this book, and how much longer are you going to be able to keep doing this?
Those are good questions. I really don't know. As for Twitter, I write one or two tweets a day. That takes me 10 minutes. The book obviously took a little longer. You know, I'd like to say that the character might say that it was a lifetime of writing, but it took me a few months. What the future holds, I have no idea. It really, if this book takes off, I'd love to do more. If not, we'll have to see what happens.
Well, I wish you success on this book, Ruth, and so pleased that we had a chance to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and keep up tweeting.
I will keep reading.
Right, I will. Ruth, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the conversation, even though it was a little bit difficult on the ear. It certainly is an interesting character, an interesting phenomenon, and wants to ask, if you find out who it is, would you please tell us? I'm not sure we agreed that we would stop trying to find out who it was. We just promised that we wouldn't reveal any information that we obtained around doing this particular interview, because staying secret is something that Ruth thinks is very important to his persona. And I guess we certainly have
her
to agree. Yeah, or her. Well, it sure sounds himish.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like a Perez Hilton who just came out, the gossip guy who came out and said that he had turned over a new leaf and he wasn't going to slam anybody.
anymore.
Never be rude to people anymore.
Oh dear. What a shame that will be.
The times are changing.
Times are changing, but we'll be back. Some things don't change, and on the Menu Radio, we'll be back after the break with another interesting interview, so stay with us.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and boy, we managed to line up some really cool interviews for this show.
You have really cool ones. Okay.
Yeah, really cool. Next up is the illustrious chef who's very much in the news now, Magnus Nilsson of restaurant Favikan in Sweden.
Yeah, I think he sets the record for the furthest away. might be the toughest reservation to get, only because you have to get 650 kilometers north of Stockholm to even get there. But his book
is just gorgeous, and everybody should try to get hold of the book, even though you're not going to have access to many of the ingredients.
And he's a very fascinating young man, too.
Yeah, so, and cute.
Yeah. We caught up with him in Charleston where he shot an alligator, or helped shoot an alligator. He was going to cook it with our good old friend Sean Brock from Husk and McCready's restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina. And he broke away from that to talk to us, so you can tell that he thought having the opportunity to talk to you through On the Menu was important. So he's an interesting young man. You'll be sure to come away with some information that you certainly didn't have before.
We've just got a hold of Magnus Nilsson, who owns the very famous restaurant, Favikan. What's the rest of it, Magnus?
Magasinet.
Which is the type of building it's in. Essentially, right now you're not in the middle of nowhere. You're in South Carolina cooking.
Yeah, I'm in Charleston.
Yeah, cooking with all our buddies in Charleston. Tell them all hello.
Yeah, we'll love them.
But your restaurant itself, you really have to go out of the way to get there.
Yeah, it's a bit far. It's far from most things, actually. Uh-huh. It's about 650 kilometers north of Stockholm towards the Norwegian side of Stockholm.
Now, are you from there? Is that how this took place?
Yeah, it's where I grew up.
Yes. And you just never left, huh?
I left, and then I went back.
Okay. Yes.
And
well, he cooked in France.
Okay. Yeah, and in the south of Sweden for some time as well.
Okay, but you're like the man who built a better mousetrap. The world will beat a pathway to your door.
Sorry?
It's a famous English expression. If you build a better mousetrap, the world will make a pathway to your door.
Exactly.
And I guess
that's sort of what I'm going for.
Yeah, better be, because people are not going to exactly stop their passing by on the way to somewhere else, are they?
No, not quite. But we're fortunate enough to have a good number of clients coming in.
You have a 12-seat restaurant, or is it 14 now?
It's anywhere between 12 and 16. We have 16 chairs, but it depends on the size of the tables, because they have only 5 tables.
Our reference is a bit strange, because we have very close Swedish friends
who
live in Nerja in the south of Spain.
Yeah.
And we go there to visit them, and there's a whole Swedish community. And there's even a restaurant that serves the traditional Swedish buffet at Christmas time.
Yeah,
and the supermarket has that fish paste or whatever it is.
The green codro in tubes. It looks like toothpaste.
I never had any indication whatsoever that there was any kind of a heritage in food beyond what these people eat.
There's a lot to it. Sweden is quite a large country, and it's a diverse country, so there's a lot to see if you dig a little bit.
Okay, so it's probably...
Maybe you didn't look quite eagerly enough.
Well, Scandinavia is frequently a winner of such international competitions as the Bocuse d'Or, but I would imagine that the cooking done there is much more traditional. Cooking probably is French technique and more traditional approaches to food.
Yeah, than we do in restaurants, definitely.
Right, yes. Yeah. Now, that leads us into this whole new thing that's exploded of new Nordic cuisine as a result of you and people like Noma and René Redzepi.
Yeah.
And then there are a couple others as well. Is this something that's all related, or I don't know quite how to put that. It just seems unusual that you all decided suddenly to be looking at what's growing in your forest.
Well, you know, I think that it's always been like that. Always been great restaurants going on in Nordic countries. It's just that most people outside of the Nordic countries didn't know about it. And suddenly when NOMA won the, you know, the sample of, you know, World's 50 Best Restaurants, that kind of opened the door to Scandinavia for all the other people. What was happening is, you know, they put kind of put the spotlight on Scandinavia. And then all of a sudden a lot of people came in and they started discovering these restaurants that many of them were already in existence.
And they all used tree bark?
No, they don't, but some of us do. The thing is that you get more customers and more influx of perhaps international customers, easier to develop your restaurant to make it even better and more interesting. So sort of it's a very good development in that way.
Now, the proximate reason why we're talking to Magnus today is that just recently, Fiden, which produces absolutely beautiful cookbooks, just produced a beautiful cookbook all about your style and your ingredients. Would it be fair to say that if you describe the dining experience at your restaurant, Fevikan, then you could say, well, the cookbook will teach you how to do these things?
Yeah, I think the cookbook, main purpose of it is perhaps not that people are going to duplicate the recipes, because that's going to be difficult for most, even to get the ingredients into. But the thing is that quite heavy on narrative text. There's a lot to read in it. So if you read through it and try to, like, hopefully enjoy it, then I think you have a pretty good chance to, if it interests you, try cooking the way we do.
But is your restaurant kind of meals, which is on the plates in the book, are a little different than your conventional restaurant?
Yeah.
So can you sort of take a few minutes to describe what a meal at Fevikan might feel like?
Ooh, that's very difficult, because I'm not the one enjoying the meal. I'm just cooking it. Describe it, how it feels as a customer. That's something that I try to avoid doing, because that's sort of up to the...
Well, if you can give us some idea, you have, for example, a very different...
I can tell you a bit what's different with the restaurant, you know,
okay.
A technical standpoint. It's just one thing is the size, obviously. It's just 12 to 16 people. So it's a very small, quite intimate experience. It's also a sort of a communal experience when it comes to eating, because everyone eats at the same time. They will have the same menu. They have no choice themselves. It's just a set menu. Everyone arrives at 7. They have drinks together, and then everyone is assigned their separate table. They are served their menu, and then they're seated again together after dinner. And this is a different approach to things. It gives a certain character.
But you have very particular things you do, such as you treat beef totally differently. You buy old milk cows.
Yeah, old dairy cow, yeah.
Yeah, why?
Well, because I think they taste better. That's sort of the end of it. It's also, I'm not particularly fond of the practice of using grain for fattening livestock, like what's actually practiced here in the U.S., because it's a very wasteful way of producing food. It consumes a lot of resources, and it doesn't give a particularly great flavor either. It just fattens them very, very quickly and makes them grow very, very quickly.
And they age much longer than we're accustomed.
Yeah, and that's something that works only if you have older animals, and that's also one of the reasons why I like dairy cows, is because they usually, when they get butchered, they're much older than your average beef steer would be, and that means also that you can age them for a long time, because they have higher collagen. Well, they can be like 8 to 10 years old.
No, I mean, how long do you age them?
Oh, that depends so much on the actual cut of beef, and it can be anything from a couple of months to up to even 9 months.
Oh my goodness.
That's a long time. Of course, it's colder there, right? And you do a lot of fermenting, which is traditional in your part of the world.
Yeah. Actually, you know, what's funny with that is that it's traditional all over the world. It's just people don't realize it.
It is.
Like every cured ham you will eat, you know, every olive you will eat, and all those things, they're all fermented. You know, they're all, like, for example,
bread and beer.
And then every piece of cheese and every piece of butter you have is also fermented in the way. And it's just that we put a little bit more sort of effort into really understand those techniques and learn them and try to perfect them.
Now, what are you going to be cooking in Charles?
Well, I'm going to cook a few things. Well, basically, what we do is that we, or Sean prepared, like he assembled a load of different produce from here, great produce, and I'm guessing to apply our techniques and our approach to those produce, and then we're going to see what happens.
Because, you know, Renee was recently cooking in New York, and he brought his own ants.
Yeah, I don't do that. No, I leave my aunts in Scandinavia. Yeah.
I didn't think they were allowed to do that, actually.
Probably not.
So you use a lot of game, which is, again, traditional.
Yeah, definitely. No, there's quite a lot of hunting going on up there. So.
And fishing.
I'm serving some game here tonight, actually, from Charles. Alligator.
Alligator?
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's great.
Interesting. Have you ever had that?
We went alligator hunting yesterday. It was a beautiful experience. Very interesting.
Well, you mean you hunted your own alligator? Did you really? They're very dangerous.
Yeah. we had good help. Yeah. I didn't just wander out in the swamp myself.
you had bigger guns than the alligators. So what else besides some vegetables and some alligator? What else is on the menu tonight?
I'm cooking some duck eggs for dessert. There's going to be fresh green peanuts. There's going to be some really good beef. There's going to be clams. I'm going to cook grits, which is going to be exciting.
What is this?
Grits. He's going to do Scandinavian grits.
Oh, that's funny.
They're going to be very Charlestonian. That's going to be cooked by me.
Well, let me give you the secret to grits.
Yeah,
when you get grits, you put salt, pepper, and butter on them, and guess what they taste like?
I have no idea.
Salt, pepper, and butter.
That's why he's going to have the good grits.
He's probably going to have Anson Mills grits, yeah. Yeah. Anson Mills grits are really good.
So, now, what else? How hard is it getting into your restaurant, Magnus?
Customer, you mean?
Yes.
It books out quite quickly, since it's so small, you know.
Yeah, I mean...
So, yeah, I think that... But, you know, we don't accept reservations further ahead than 90 days in future. So, people have... Like, if you have a date when you're really keen on coming, you have a fair chance of getting a table if you just book 90 days ahead when the reservations for that particular date open.
90 days.
Yeah.
Okay, and you have rooms there. People stay overnight?
Yeah, we have 6 rooms as well.
Okay, and what else about there? You do a lot of wild plants. You always known about these wild plants, or did you have to really start researching all your potential ingredients?
I know a little bit of them, you know, obviously, and it's part of my upbringing and my tradition at home, but also you have to do a bit of research. That's kind of what's interesting. You always have to try to find new things to do and develop what you have.
I could actually make some of these things because we have some of these ingredients in our backyard.
I'm sure you have. They're like quite many of them are quite common all over the world.
Yeah, wood sorrel, we have a lot of that.
Yeah, that's delicious.
Yeah, I like it. So, mushrooms is another issue. You were also well-trained hunting mushrooms growing up?
Yeah, definitely. It's actually, mushroom picking is the most popular time in Sweden. A lot of people grew up hunting mushrooms.
I see. And, yeah, you have to know what you're doing, though, right?
Yeah, but they're a good mushrooms book.
Well, otherwise you don't have to worry about it. you don't get a second or a third chance, I guess. Eat the wrong kind.
Well, now, how are you going to... You do not have a large staff?
In the restaurant at home or here?
At home.
At home, no, it's a small team. We're 9 people working there in total, you know, and 3 of them are front of house.
Oh, okay. Well, that's still a lot for 12, 14
people. It is, but in general terms, it's quite a small team.
No, they're open for business while you're not there?
It's closed at this point, yeah. It's closed at this moment. It opens again next week.
So this is when you get back?
There's going to be, like, I think it's 3 days open without me this time.
Okay, so we'll be open just a little
bit. I kind of try to avoid that. It's not that it gets any less good when I'm not there. It's just that I don't like it. I like being there.
So it sounds like you have a wonderful time.
Yeah, I am. I'm having a really good time.
Well, I think that everybody ought to just get a hold of this book and read it. I mean, there's so many fascinating things that are unfamiliar, such as vinegar matured in the burnt-out trunk of a spruce tree. Now, that's a bit obscure, isn't it?
That's delicious.
It sounds like the closest thing you could come to a leftover wine barrel to me.
Yeah, a bit like that, yeah.
Probably, yeah.
We know that you have to rush
off.
We promised
your publicist that we'd let
Thank
let
you so
you
much
know.
For your time.
Thanks for talking to me. Have a nice afternoon, guys. That's great.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, I really enjoyed talking to our next guest, Ken Forkish, who has an artisanal bake shop and an artisanal pizza shop in one of our most favorite places, Portland, Oregon. And he has his new book out, really gives you not only some great ideas for making bread and pizza, but tells secrets about how you can get bread that actually tastes good, not just looks good or has the right texture. And he's full of information, and he had an unusual journey getting to where he is now. So let's listen to Ken Forkish. You know, once upon a time, Anne Haig used to bake bread, and it was such a thrilling experience, especially the kneading of it. which I've had talks with Jim Leahy about that, that half my love of bread baking was the knead. And, of course, he does no knead bread. But anyhow, I sort of lapsed because we don't have enough people eating bread in the house anymore. And here in the mail, I get a book called Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, The Fundamentals of Artisan Bread and Pizza by Ken Forkish. And I'm inspired all over again, Ken.
Well, thanks, Anne.
Your story is a bit unusual. I say that, but in fact, I find that it's less and less unusual. People who started out doing some soup job and then ending up doing artisanal baking or cake making or candy making kind of thing. But it's good to repeat the story because you really had a learning curve, didn't you?
Well, I did. This is not a hobby. It's a profession.
Right.
And like any profession, there's a fair bit of knowledge and experience before you come really proficient at it. So, yeah.
But you were a high technology guy.
That's correct, yeah.
For 20 years.
Yeah, I had 19 years, mostly in Silicon Valley, corporate America, and even some of the small companies. It was a very different culture than the one that I live in now.
Yeah, I should say. You look very pleasant. There's a picture of you on the dust jacket.
It took a lot of shots to get me looking pleasant.
But at any rate, so you decided that you were going to drop this day-to-day grind and do something that was much more satisfying to you. And an article from National Geographic that a friend gave you was about Poland.
Yeah, actually, it was January 1995 article in Smithsonian Magazine. It was the cover article about a very famous French baker, Lionel Poulin. And Poulin was famous for bringing back old-school breads made in very old traditional ways, baked in wood-fired ovens. And he repopularized those breads at a point in time when most people were buying kind of supermarket-style white breads.
Wonder Bread.
Even in France.
Even in France, huh? So what did you do? Describes in the book that you jumped off a cliff. I mean, actually.
Those are Peter Reinhardt's words on the jacket. You know, basically, it was one of those things where I needed to learn a new trade. And so I just kind of retired from my last career, or quit, or chucked the job, depending on how you want to look at it. And I searched out some good baking schools. The best school for artisan baking in the U.S. was and still is the San Francisco Baking Institute.
Yeah, that's where you went, huh?
Yeah, and I got my most probably the best training I got was there. And I also studied at a place called the National Baking Center at the Dunwoody Institute in Minneapolis, which is no longer active. But they had two excellent French instructors. I had a week with Didier Rosada, who taught an outstanding bread class, and then a second week with Philippe Lecour, who taught a classic European pastries class. And so basically, I had some introductory training, essentially a week here, 2 weeks there, to wet my whistle, so to speak, and kind of give me a sense and basic training for baking the kind of bread and pastry that I wanted to bake.
And you headed off, you studied in Italy, studied in France. And when did you decide you were ready to take the leap into your own business?
Well, it kind of evolved. In the beginning, my initial plan was to simply open a very simple bread bakery and deliver bread to wholesale markets. And that didn't work out. It's a long story, but I tell it in the book.
Yeah,
I'm not going to try to retell it here.
Yeah.
But it got to the point where I realized I needed to train in both bread and classic pastry, things like croissants and rustic fruit tarts and brioche and so forth. So I continued my study in France for just a couple of weeks. And then after a while, I just wanted to get a lot of repetition under my hands, which is something you don't get in a school environment. And I decided to do the rest of my training pretty much on the job in real time.
Uh-huh.
So,
jump forward. You are now the owner of bread shop and a pizza shop in Portland, Oregon, which is a ways from where you started.
That's correct. My bakery, it's a French bakery, so we do bread and pastry.
We do a
large lunch business, but the bread and the pastries that we do represent the kind of products you would find at a good boulangerie in Paris. We make croissants, pain au chocolat, brioche, about five or six different products from our croissant dough. We make one called an Oregon croissant that's made with hazelnuts and local berries.
Nice.
We make a ham and cheese croissant there's a place called Tails and Trotters here in Oregon that they
They raise hogs for slaughter that are finished on hazelnuts. And it's just fantastic ham. And so we're buying local hams for a lot of things that we make.
Yeah, we make
including
those.
Our ham and cheese croissants. So essentially, it's a full-line bakery. It's not just bread.
Okay.
But you do also make bread.
I'm sorry, Peter?
But you do also make classic French bread.
Yes, indeed we do. We make baguettes. We make several different kinds of a levain bread. We make a ciabatta. We bake from 600 to 1,000 loaves a day.
Oh, my. Okay.
It's a 2,000-square-foot bakery. It's a very active little space.
Now, you actually founded this business when you moved to Portland?
That is correct, yeah.
So, but you chose Portland for a number of reasons, including the weather, you said.
But the weather ended up being secondary, although I do like the climate here because it's temperate. So, yeah, we get a lot of cloudy days and a lot of rain, but we don't have harsh summers and we don't have harsh winters. And our summertime is actually... It's probably the best place to be weather-wise in the country for July, August, September. So I actually like the weather here. When it gets a little gray by March, the airport's close by.
Yeah.
Did you know that it was such a food town when you got there, before you got there?
Well, it was just beginning.
Yeah,
and Portland now is a lot different than Portland was when I opened my bakery in 2001. Although the seeds were planted. Corey Schreiber at Wildwood and Greg Higgins at Higgins Restaurant and Vitaly Paley at Paley's Place were three seminal chefs here in Portland. The rest of us are enjoying, which is they helped develop a really strong connection between local farms and chefs. And one of the things that I really enjoy about being two food businesses here in Portland is I get outstanding produce delivered to me by the farmers themselves at least 5 days a week.
This book is described by somebody as not just a book about bread and pizza. It's a full educational course in both making bread and pizza. I mean, you really get down to the nitty gritty. In fact, by page 3, I think you're already over my head.
Well, I really intended this to be an excellent book for both beginners as well as advanced bakers.
No, I'm sure it is. It's just that I had never considered these things. I mean, I know about the fact that everything should be weighed rather than measured. And
I've
always believed in mixing everything by hand and doing all that by hand. And I knew about raising and so forth, but you put a whole new perspective on it when you talk about three different methods of bread
fermentation. Yeah. I wrote the book that I wanted to read when I was learning to be a baker. So when I was learning to be a baker, of course, I took classes and I bought all the good bread books that I could find, and I was often not finding the answers I was looking for. And so the seed for the idea of this book really was planted in my mind back when I was learning to become a baker, and the reason that I wrote, you know, hopefully a thinking man's bread book without being pedantic or too fussy about details is just to explain what's going on throughout the process from beginning to end.
Yeah, because that's the part that I didn't really have a name for. I understand what autolyse is, but I didn't understand it was called autolyse.
Well, you just mix the flour and the water, and you let it rest for 20 minutes before you add yeast and salt to the dough. Yeah.
And while we're at it, what is poulish and biga?
Poulish and biga are two common forms of what's called a pre-ferment. And the idea is that you can mix a bread dough with a portion of the flour pre-fermented. So basically, you do two mixes to make a single bread dough. And the benefit is you get an extra degree of fermentation that adds flavor to the dough.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's all about adding flavor.
Fermentation is the process.
You also get better keeping qualities.
But fermentation is the different processes, or it's the process. And
the rising of bread is a fermentation, which it is. And to orient themselves to thinking, well, what are the variables that impact fermentation? Time, temperature in particular, the amount of leavening. Those are the critical components that affect fermentation. And if you try to make bread in 2 hours, you don't give the bread an opportunity to develop the kind of flavors that I'm looking for that really make bread to be something that I want to eat.
Huh.
So it's as much about flavor as it is about getting air into the bread?
Absolutely, yeah. For flavor, to get the kind of flavor that I want, to get the kind of flavor that you find in a really good quality, what we think of as artisan bread, what I really call French bread, it takes time. And time, I try to, I write in my book to think of time as ingredient. And you need enough time for bacterial fermentation, for acidity to develop, for good flavors to happen. And so the bread recipes in this book and the pizza dough recipes in this book, they take a lot of elapsed time with very little actual effort. And so as I was doing the recipes that take a long elapsed time, I said, we need different schedules, because the schedule that works for one person might not work for the lifestyle of someone else. So I turned that into a feature of the book, is different recipes that operate on very different schedules but still give long development times in the dough so that you can get the kind of flavors that I'm looking for.
Now, where do you come down on no-knead bread? We just had somebody
Jim Leahy
talk about no-knead pizza.
And he also had no-knead bread.
Yeah, previous to that, we had somebody who was a great guru of no-knead bread.
Jim Leahy.
No, there was a lady.
First time
we talked to somebody about no-knead bread, it was a lady, and I can't remember.
Mark Bittman is the first one who wrote that article about Jim Leahy. There's somebody else who was doing it.
Doesn't matter.
But anyhow, actually, Ken knows Jim Leahy because he references him in his book.
Okay, so now you can answer the question. Now we've had our little argument, you can answer the question.
Yeah, I was going to ask you wanted some boxing mitts, but... You know, it's kind of, the no-knead thing is, yeah, I'll give that one to Jim.
He's
someone
right.
I admire. Yeah. I've been to his bakery in New York, and I admire his books.
I think it was Peter Reinhardt, or was it Malgieri?
Malgieri.
Yeah, I mean, I asked one of them about this no-knead stuff, and they said that it was a little, how did they describe it? The texture was different.
It is. I wouldn't call my bread no-knead. I use a technique for mixing the dough by hand in a 12-quart Cambro dough tub. You can use an equivalent container that you have in your kitchen. But for me, it's mixing. The word kneading to me implies kind of a stiff dough that you work really hard with your muscles and it's very active. I do a technique for mixing the dough by hand that I actually learned when I was a student at the San Francisco Baking Institute. But the idea is really just to incorporate the ingredients and develop the gluten structure in the dough lightly. It's not very involved. It's pretty easy to do. But it's a little bit more engaged with the dough than the simple no-kneading that the Jim Leahy promotes. Texture is a little bit different between the breads, but it's been a while since I've done a side-by-side comparison, so I don't have the visuals in my brain anymore.
Tell me, you are outstanding at a certain style called Levant, and how is that? What do you do with that? You catch stuff out of the air or what?
Well, Levant is the French word for sourdough, and I don't like to use the word sourdough because my bread tastes sour. That means I've had a bad day. But basically, whether it's Levant, which is the French word, or sourdough, what that really implies is naturally leavened bread that use wild yeast instead of commercial yeast that you buy in packages at the store. And the wild yeast, they exist. They're in the air. They're in the soil. They're in the water. You may not see it, but wild yeast is everywhere, and I'm kind of fascinated by.
I'm fascinated, but how do you
the fact of it? You know?
What if you get the wrong kind of wild stuff in
there?
Well,
basically, yeah, because there are thousands of varieties of yeast. There are yeast that live on grapes. There are yeast that works well in a flower environment. Yeast that live on the skins of fruits, so on and so forth. But basically, say, well, how do you capture the right kind of yeast? Essentially, the environment, you build up a culture of flour and water, which is how you develop this Levant culture. It's very simple to do, and I explain in my book how you can develop an active Levant culture in just 5 days with only using whole wheat flour and warm water. But it's kind of a self-selecting environment, and so the yeasts that naturally live well in a wheat flour environment are those that will survive and will propagate.
So, and that's safe then. It's not the same as, I have to restrain Peter from hanging up hams and ducks and things in our awful old-fashioned basements.
I wouldn't restrain all unless he gets sick. Sounds good to me.
There's probably some yeast down there too.
There's yeast and other things that are going to grow in my...
So you two know each other pretty well, I take it?
Not hardly. No, we've never spent any time together. It was just a meeting of chance about 8 years ago that we started this program. We didn't know each other before that.
He's making this up, of course.
We found out a lot about each other doing the program. I suspect you and whoever your partner is probably had the same experience as you were trying to explain your craziness in opening a bakery in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, you know, if I had been married at the time, I'm not sure the marriage would have survived it.
Anyhow, I don't know what else to say because there's such a depth of information.
Well, yeah, all I have to say is buy the book.
I would say buy the book, and you're going to learn because the way it's explained is it's easy to understand and grasp, and you just have to apply yourself to taking the time to do things properly. Is that correct, Ken?
That's correct, and time does most of the good work for you. As I read in the book, good flavors build while you sleep. It's not a lot of physical engagement. It's not hard to do, and that's what I try to represent, is that these things are actually pretty simple to do. You just need to learn the right steps and have a good teacher. And then as I was writing the book, I said I want to do some videos to demonstrate the techniques, which I recently put up on my YouTube channel.
Oh.
And so all the methods in the book, I now have videos that demonstrate how to do these things. So hopefully that will be helpful for the people who buy it.
What's that location so people can find it?
You can access it through my website, which is at kensartisan.com.
Kensartisan.com.
And that links right to my YouTube channel, and I don't know what it's called.
they're just now putting up all these new YouTube channels, and I don't understand it. I mean, sometimes
the other thing I wanted to point out while you have me on the air is that it's not a book just about bread. It's about bread and pizza.
Right, which is my favorite
pizzeria, we bake a Neapolitan-style pizza, and I was trying to reproduce the quality of that, the DNA of that pizza here in my book.
Yeah, well, you don't have to sell me on pizza. I love it. My favorite food.
Well, Anne will be by to see you next time we're in Portland, even if I'm not. So, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu, and we wish you success, continued success with your bakery, and great success with your book. And right after the break, we'll have another fascinating segment for you, so just don't go away. Just stay with us, and we'll be back right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up is another baker, a very, very smart and humorous woman, a great sense of humor, and a great spirit about her. Her book, Tate's Bake Shop, Baking for Friends, will surely get you in the mood for all that holiday baking that's coming on the horizon. So listen to Kathleen King. We have a new book out from Kathleen King called Baking for Friends. Kathleen, your bake shop, named after your father, Tate's Bake Shop in Southampton, is a phenom, really. Your product's available like all over the place. What did you say, 5,000 shops?
We have over 5,000 locations across the United States.
And do you have store locators on your website?
No, I don't. But if you email on our website and give us your zip code, they'll tell you exactly where you can find the product to your home. The website is tatesbakeshop.com.
Okay. No, T-A-T-E-S, bakeshop.
Yes.
.com.
That's correct.
Okay. And so you also... It's the e-bakery. People can also order the baked goods from the shop?
Yes, we have just the items that are on the website. Not everything that's in our bake shop, but the items. We have certain items picked out and wrapped in gift boxes and gift baskets on our website, which can be ordered. And also on our website, you can enter our current baking contest that we're having with a $1,000 grand prize.
And what is that? What do you bake?
There's 5 recipes from the Baking for Friends cookbook that we have chosen, and you can make your own modifications on those, and the winner will win $1,000, and it's also sponsored with KitchenAid, so we are giving away KitchenAid mixers also.
Now that gets me excited.
No, hold on.
So that's an exciting thing. If you visit our website, tatesbakeshop.com, you can enter there.
No, people have to send you the goods.
The recipe.
Oh, they send you the recipe, that's all.
Yes, okay. Yes.
They don't actually have to send you the cake or cookie or whatever.
No.
Now, it seems to me, Kathleen, that you're extraordinarily bold. Perhaps not exactly the world's best business person, because this is the second book you've written. So this is the second time you've explained to people how you make all the stuff you make. And seems like you're giving that away for the price of the book. That's really quite amazing.
Well, it's not all the recipes from the bake shop. You know, we do some of them, but not everything from the shop. And, of course, making 12 cookies and making 60 million cookies, it's you can't quite take a recipe and transform it into those levels unless you really know what you're doing and you actually have the real recipe.
So you're not worried that you're cutting into your own business?
No.
Kathleen, I'm not a baker at all, so I'm asking you, is it true that you have all these things hanging around your pantry so that you can at the drop of a hat bake things. And
oh, yes. Didn't get married till I was 45.
Really?
Yeah. And if you came to my house, you always thought a family of four lived there because I always just ran like a full house. And
that's funny.
To make something really yummy, basically you need butter, flour, and sugar, and you can make something with that. And then the other pieces are just add-ons.
So what is the difference between baking for friends and baking for your bake shop?
Well, baking for my bake shop is like baking for friends. Basically, baking for friends or baking for my customers is all trying to make people happy, except baking for friends, they get it for free.
Yes, but you're known as the sugar fairy?
Oh, yes, I have a nickname of...
You drop cookies and cakes in people's mailboxes?
Yes, it's really fun to... Again, I lived alone for a long time, and now I'm married. It's just my husband and I, and my son is off. And how much can you eat if you really like to bake? So I bake, and I test recipes, and I test things for the bake shop. And then I drop a few muffins in one friend's mailbox or here and there, and just send them a text that there's a little prize in their mailbox. And it's very fun, and they love it.
I have a neighbor who's... she's 97 or 8, and she chef baker at the Kaufman Frank Lloyd Wright Estate, Falling Water.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and she's a neighbor, and she's amazing. She's this itty-bitty thing, and she will call me and say, meet me on the street. I have a cake for you.
Right. And it's fun, right?
Yeah, and she bakes for all the other tenants in her apartment. I mean, I wish I had her energy. She kind of helps me out of the car.
Well, it's all that unexpected phone call, that sharing of this delightful thing. It's great.
It looks like
day a little better.
Because you grew up on a farm.
I did, out here in Southampton.
Yeah, see, I think that gives you a head start on understanding this kind.
Well, I think growing up farm gives you a head start on a lot of lot of things. The upbringing and the lifestyle is slightly different from the norm in a positive way.
You were 11. You set up your own cookie stand.
I did, but that was basically because my father had said at 11 years old I was old enough to buy my own clothes school, and so that I had to make my own money and save it. So that's what I did, and here we are.
Well, now, most of these recipes are pretty straightforward old favorites. Would you call them favorites?
Yes.
Thumbprint cookies and things?
Yes. Whenever I put a book together or put recipes together, it's really all about quality ingredients and simplicity. I want people to understand that they can take the book off the shelf, open it up, make a recipe that doesn't take all day, comes out great, tastes great, and, you know, move on. It's not a coffee table cookbook. It's one that hopefully has lots of stains and bent pages when you're done with it.
But you've also got these great green pages. So at the beginning...
Well, yeah, that's our Tate's color, and it's a beautiful design and nice and easy to use.
No, the green pages, I call them green, and I guess they are fairly green. They're at the beginning of each section of the book, and they're a set of...
Oh, the baking tips.
The baking tips, exactly. And listeners, just in case you think this lady's not thorough, she says in the section about cakes... You can use a toothpick to test your cake and to find out if it's done, or you can use a cake tester. And then she says, but remember where you put the cake tester. So you'll always be able to find it. And since not being able to find certain kitchen tools is a problem that happens in this house quite frequently, we appreciate that advice, and we will try to take advantage of it.
Yes, we're all in the same boat on there, I think.
It's just hard to remember where you put it the last time you used it. And
I'm
very guilty of that because I'm sure I'm not very consistent in where I put things.
I try to do that because being working in a commercial kitchen most of my life, I think every day I say, if everybody would just put everything back where they found it, we'd save a lot of time.
Oh, yes, right. Would you remember Julia Child, her husband, did an outline of all her utensils on a pegboard?
Yes, yes.
She'd be able to put them back in the right places.
Yes, yes.
She probably still didn't do it anyway.
But the thing that I really admire about this book is you really tend to streamline things. You say, no, this is how I do it, and it might help you do it more easily and fast, but you could do it your own way if you want to.
Sure.
Yeah, and you also, these tips are not only time-saving, but they allow you to make more things that you have pre-prepared. Is that the right word for it?
I'm really big into time management and advanced preparation. I like to do pieces of recipes, always keeping pie crusts and tart shells in my freezer, crisp toppings in the Ziploc bag, dough balls, because always it seems to be when you're having people for dinner or someone's coming over, that's not the day you have time. It always works out that way. So when I have time, I make those preparations.
Well, I think that's brilliant. I mean, I always let the dessert go to the last minute for a dinner party, and then I'm so exhausted from everything else that I get frantic.
Right, right. And then it's not fun, and the whole idea should be fun.
Now, you also do something very modern. We all know that there are all kinds of demands for food having to do with allergies or habits or philosophies. So you have a whole section on tips for health and lifestyle baking.
Yes.
I can't
yes.
tell you how many people I know that have gluten allergies.
Yes, we recently have on the market a gluten-free chocolate chip cookie, which is doing amazingly well on the open market, and do a gluten-free line. I have a niece that's gluten-free, and then there's vegan, and there's nut allergies. And
oh, yeah.
I tried to at least have something for everybody in the book.
Yeah, this, I don't know where it's going to go, but don't you make your gluten-free stuff, does it taste like iced cardboard? That's what
I thought. No, our gluten-free chocolate chip cookies are amazing. And actually, the gluten-free recipes in the cookbook are also very delicious. If you've made them and served them to your husband, he probably wouldn't even know.
Well, you have gluten-free bakery in our town. And,
And
it tastes exactly like cardboard, everything we make.
Oh, that's a shame, because it doesn't have to.
Right. Well, Thomas Keller has...
Which one?
Thomas Keller has gluten-free chocolate.
Flour. Yes, right. I mean, we make... It's gluten-free flour. It's really just a mix of, like, three different ingredients. We make our own over here.
But it's expensive.
And at home, I make my own mix also.
I had a plasterer who has just been diagnosed with a celiac, and he says that... At this gluten-free bakery, he gets a bag of flour, and it's $15.
Yeah.
It's very expensive.
I mean, it's great, and it's a marketing thing, but you can make your own.
And what do you put in it?
Well, we use rice flour and Xanax gum and either a tapioca starch or an arrowroot starch.
Now, tell me, from your perspective here, the direction that I see all these people going in is, like, the cupcakes never seem to be going away.
Yes.
They're always... That and cake pop, they still hot items?
Cake pops, I think, are newer. Cupcakes, they've been around forever, and they're popular, and cake pops are newer. I don't see those as much, but they're definitely around, and I've actually tried some, which are quite delicious.
Right. But it seems to me, was it Crumbs? Bake Shop Crumbs?
Yes.
It became public office.
Yes. They sold their company, and growing quite large, I'm sure, as we speak.
Yeah, were you aiming to become a billionaire?
No, I have no interest in becoming a billionaire. I'm quite happy the way I am.
Are you tempted by, have you noticed how just icing isn't good enough now? They're making these real high concept cakes, like this Cake Boss that does all these outrageous things.
Well, those are amazing. The people that decorate like that, they're real artists. I am not an artist. I cannot even begin to make a cake as beautiful as the Cake Boss, but I can make it taste really good.
Oh, that's wonderful. My trainer actually has, on one end she has a gym, and the other hand she has a bake shop. So she gets you both ways.
That's perfect. That's the perfect balance.
But they do things like Rubik's Cubes and cakes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Nope, I had a master decorator at the bake shop once, Joe Gilmartin, and it was really fun employing him here because he could make anything, do anything.
So that's our future, or no, basically
I
people
don't know.
Come back to the wonderful scones that you make?
I do simple American baked goods, and I've done it all my life, and it's never gone out of fashion. So that's my niche. I'm glad that it's a kind of solid, stable niche that I chose.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, so listeners, you can do it yourself by buying the book, or you can indulge yourself by finding what local store will provide you, or you can get on the website. So there's really no excuse
why you shouldn't have cookies
except if you're on a diet, I suppose.
Right.
Well, Kathleen, good luck with your book and continued success with your business, and stay happy because you sound happy.
Oh, thank you, Anne, and thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Right. Talk to you again, I'm sure.
Great.
And, folks, that's all for this week.
Yeah,
we'll
you know,
see you
I'm
again.
Sorry that I've been particularly tongue-tied.
Have you been tongue-tied?
Reason. And I don't know if it's because it's been a very long day or because it's sort of grim and spooky outside, raining and the branches beating against the windows.
Yeah, suitable for the season,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Perfect Halloween weather.
Oh, dear.
But anyhow.
We'll be back same time, same place next week. We hope you'll be with us again.
Bye-bye.